from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. The first public impeachment hearings in over two decades began yesterday. The five-hour nationally broadcast hearing included new details on allegations that President Trump pressured Ukraine to investigate Joe Biden's family. William Taylor, the top American diplomat in Ukraine, testified that a staffer was told Trump cared more about investigations of the Bidens than Ukraine. We'll discuss the first day of public impeachment hearings, and we do want to hear from you. Did you watch or listen to the hearings? Did anything surprise you? Change your mind? It's all coming up next, after the news. Welcome to this morning's forum. I'm Michael Krasny. The House of Representatives public impeachment hearing began yesterday with Intelligence Committee Chair, Democratic California Congressman Adam Schiff, saying that the future of the presidency itself is at stake. He also recalled how Acting Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney responded to questions about the president's Ukraine call last month with the comment, "Get over it."
The issue that we confront is the one posed by the president's acting chief of staff when he challenged Americans to get over it. If we find that the president of the United States abused his power and invited foreign interference in our elections, or if he sought to condition, coerce, extort, or bribe an ally into conducting investigations to aid his reelection campaign and did so by withholding official acts, a White House meeting, or hundreds of millions of dollars of needed military aid, must we simply get over it?
The five-hour nationally broadcast hearing featured detailed testimony from two witnesses seen as keys to the case, U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine William Taylor and George Kent, the State Department's top official on Ukraine policy. Republican Congress members challenged those witnesses, and though rather than defend the president's actions with Ukraine, they mainly criticized the process and made the case the Democrats were ignoring other issues. Here's California Congressman Devin Nunes.
What is the full extent of the Democrats' prior coordination with the whistleblower? And who else did the whistleblower coordinate this effort with? Second, what is the full extent of Ukraine's election meddling against the Trump campaign? And third, why did Burisma hire Hunter Biden, and what did he do for them? And did his position affect any U.S. government actions under the Obama administration? These questions will remain outstanding because Republicans were denied the right to call witnesses that know these answers. What we will witness today is a televised theatrical performance staged by the Democrats.
Joining us is Scott Anderson. He's a fellow in governance studies at Brookings, and he's also senior editor and counsel for Lawfare. And welcome, Scott Anderson. Good to have you back with us.
Thank you for having me.
Let me begin by just saying that from all consensus, the two witnesses that gave testimony before the hearing yesterday were not only credible, but they were impressive. They were both career diplomats, and they both at least certainly came across by most perspectives as nonpartisan and said they were not never Trumpers. I'm wondering about the headline story here, though, that came out in the testimony, which is essentially that there was a phone call between EU Ambassador Gordon Sondland and President Trump. And that phone call revealed that an associate, or I should say actually someone who works with Ambassador Taylor, was hearing a conversation between the president and Ambassador Sondland, who will testify next week. And in fact, there will be testimony from the aide who actually heard this conversation. And the conversation said pretty flat, according to at least the testimony, President Trump was heard speaking about the day after the conversation he had with President Zelensky of Ukraine. He was speaking directly about what happened, and that was meant by Gordon Sondland, or interpreted to mean what happened with Joe Biden, with his political, what he perceived as his political opponent. And we go right to the law on this, Scott Anderson, with you. I mean, are we talking about something here, and it has to be proven, of course, if this was not a trial, despite the fact that many felt it seemed to be like a trial, Ken Starr, perhaps most notably. But I'm just wondering your take on this just in terms of the legal implications of it. What does it mean in terms of high crimes and misdemeanors?
Absolutely. What we are in the middle of right now is impeachment proceedings. And that's a process that has legal frames and certain legal bounds, but also involves a degree of political judgment. And the question of what has constituted treason, bribery, and other high crimes and misdemeanors, those are the offenses for which a president and other officials can be impeached, is always the subject of a little bit of academic debate. We haven't just had enough impeachments and enough judicial rulings, or any really judicial rulings on that question, to clarify it 100%. But we do know, essentially, is that the underlying logic of most, if not all, of the offenses that have fallen in that bucket, what is a high crime and misdemeanor, follows the same logic as treason and bribery, the two offenses identified most specifically, in that they relate to a betrayal of fiduciary duty, this idea that a public official is acting in a way that is inconsistent with the duty that they owe to the American people and to the United States and to preserve and advance U.S. national interests. That is what arguably is happening here. That's the real question of this impeachment inquiry. It is
so
whether
forgive me, you're
or
talking,
not.
You're talking about Scott about taxpayer money being used essentially to manipulate or to persuade or to lean on. In other words, that's why we heard words like extortion and bribery and so forth.
Yeah, exactly. And not just the taxpayer money. This is really compromising U.S. national security interests. And that was a big part of George Kent and Ambassador Taylor's testimony yesterday, is laying out here's why the Ukraine is so important to U.S. national security interests. And yet, implicitly, the Trump administration and President Trump himself were willing to compromise that or put that at risk in order to extract these concessions, specifically in the form of investigations into the CrowdStrike server and into the Bidens. And that really is the, you know, betrayal of this fiduciary duty that people who support impeachment are trying to illustrate here. They're saying the president did this only in his own self-interest, and he's willing to compromise the interests of the American people to accomplish that.
Well, let
and
us that hear that clip from Ambassador Taylor. I'd just like our listeners to hear it.
Following that meeting, in the presence of my staff, at a restaurant, Ambassador Sondland called President Trump and told him of his meetings in Kyiv. The member of my staff could hear President Trump on the phone asking Ambassador Sondland about the investigations. Ambassador Sondland told President Trump the Ukrainians were ready to move forward. Following the call with President Trump, the member of my staff asked Ambassador Sondland what President Trump thought about Ukraine. Ambassador Sondland responded that President Trump cares more about the investigations of Biden, which Giuliani was pressing for.
We're talking about the public impeachment hearing with Scott Anderson, fellow in governance studies at Brookings. He's also senior editor and counsel for Lawfare. And what about that cut? I mean, particularly in light of the fact that some are saying, well, that wouldn't hold up in a court of law if this actually was a trial.
That's really not a relevant question, to be completely honest with you. It all comes with this idea of hearsay, which is saying, well, we want witnesses with firsthand, knowledge to be testifying to something. In the first hand, the hearsay rule is kind of is a rule in U.S. criminal and civil procedure. It's not in lots of other countries, but it is here. But it's one that's subject to lots and lots of exceptions, including cases where you have contemporaneous recordings and business records and all sorts of other things. And it's not a requirement in this sort of proceeding. This is, again, not a judicial trial. This is an impeachment proceeding, meaning it is an exercise by Congress to try and gather information that it needs and that it determines is reliable enough to make the judgment that the president is acting in a way that warrants impeachment. They can evaluate the credibility of these witnesses, and there are lots of witnesses here who seem fairly credible, Taylor and Ken among them. Hearsay, you know, is just one factor or consideration that enters into this. It by no means disqualifies this sort of testimony. And in this case, we have a potential witness, this new staffer, who had a direct conversation with Sondland and then overheard this call between Sondland and the president. So he has this kind of firsthand connect information. It's not required, but it may help lay some of these complaints about the secondhand nature of this information to rest. And it should be noted, a lot of that secondhand information is what is being relied upon because the White House has refused to release documents or to allow White House staffers to testify as to what they saw and overheard. And that sort of stonewalling means that you are only getting witnesses that are a little removed from the events here. The White House
let me
could
go to
allow
that if
those
I
witnesses
can.
To testify.
Scott, I'm glad you brought that up because we do have people essentially, at least technically, breaking the law by not willing to give depositions. We're talking about a whole range of people, from everybody from John Bolton and Rick Perry to Mick Mulvaney. And what congressional power is there against this?
Well, that's a question that's going to be brought before a court, essentially, right now as it's being debated. There is a legitimate scope of what is often called executive privilege, which is a universe of information that the executive branch has long asserted it can protect from public disclosure or from congressional inquiry. That is a scope of information that usually has to relate to, like, policy deliberations or major communications between the president and his senior advisors. But this administration has asserted it very broadly. And then they've gone beyond that. They've said this impeachment inquiry is invalid and illegitimate, and we're just not going to cooperate with it because of that. And therefore, we're not going to provide a lot of information. In some cases, they exert executive privilege. In other cases, it's not clear that's exactly what they're doing, but they're still not cooperating. The courts may eventually, and hopefully will eventually, weigh in to resolve those issues and say where they are legally right, where they are legally wrong, and not cooperating with this information. But the key point here is, and Speaker Pelosi actually just got at this earlier this morning in some comments, is that the White House is free to voluntarily bring this information forward. If it has exculpatory information, information that would indicate the president was not acting in this way that's being testified to by all these other witnesses, then they can bring that forward and present it publicly and present it to Congress. That would be a very effective defense. But we haven't seen any steps in that direction. And that is problematic, I think, for people who are trying to weigh all the evidence available to them.
I should also mention that Ambassador Taylor had notes, which are not being turned over as well, which the Congress has asked for. Talking to Scott Anderson, I want to bring Margaret Tolov into this conversation. She's politics and White House editor for Axios. And welcome, Margaret. Good to have you.
Thanks so much. It's great to be with you.
Well, I think it's safe to say that the Democrats were trying to really make the case and moving toward it fact by fact and testimony by testimony, which we'll see ongoing when Sondland and others that we mentioned will be called before the Congress to testify. I'm just wondering if what you saw unfold yesterday was essentially the Republicans trying to counter this with, at least in part, well, nothing really happened here. There was no statement by the Zelensky, that is the president of Ukraine, did not make a statement about the Biden family and an investigation, and military aid was given. So that seems to be, at least in part, the argument. Nothing really happened.
Yeah, you know, it was really interesting. Yesterday we saw, like, several arguments being kind of thrown against the wall all at the same time, and that was one of them. Another one was that in a court of law, if this was a real court of law, you know, this would be hearsay. That's sort of, so arguing that this is not, doesn't have the legitimacy of a legal proceeding is one theory. Arguing that the money in the end was given or that Zelensky didn't know about it at the time is another bit of it. The notion that this is relying on people who didn't directly talk to the president when, in fact, the people who did directly talk to the president have been restrained from testifying. But mostly, I think what the Republicans are counting on is that this is going to be convoluted and be kind of old school, right? Like, you can imagine 40 years ago, this plays out on TV. TV is the only way other than a once-a-day print product that people can find stuff out. People watch the news. There's one solid narrative. And as you know, now we all rely on our phones, on Twitter, on a synopsis, on a soundbite of things that happened. And I think more than the arguments themselves, what the Republicans are counting on is that the American people are not going to have the patience or the inclination to watch hours and weeks of testimony, sift through it, and that when they turn to their favorite news outlet, they'll get coverage that validates the position they already held. And we saw some of that happen yesterday. I mean, Axios did a great piece this morning taking screenshots of CNN, Fox, and MSNBC, and the Fox headline says deep state against Trump from the start on Russia. So there's a lot going on here, and it's kind of a combination of can a weeks-long old-school hearing format work in today's modern age of media communications, and can Republicans convince Americans through one format or another that the inquiry is not legitimate?
Well, this is political theater, and the real question comes down to how will the public respond to it. But I'm interested in the responses you gave in terms of what the Republicans put forward, because they also put forward a notion that somehow there was meddling by Ukraine in the 2016 election, in the campaign at least. And they brought forth what some would put under the generic category of conspiracy arguments. I'm talking specifically about dossiers and Fusion GPS and Black
CrowdStrike and yes.
Yeah. I mean, all this was brought in, I suppose, you know, to convince the public that there are deeper state things going on here.
Right. And of course, you know, the public has to judge this on its own merits. But let's just stipulate that it's 2019, 3 years after the 2016 election, but just months away from the real nitty gritty of the 2020 election, that the front runner, certainly at the time and maybe now, depending on which polls you listen to, was Joe Biden, and that the president did not have a long history ahead of this call of making inquiries about, hey, how are corruption investigations going in the Ukraine? And nor has he sort of pursued a real public face to the notion that he wants to really unpack everything that happened in 2016. So there's reasons to be kind of dubious of this storyline, but I think it is Bill Taylor's testimony and what we what could happen based on the depositions of his staffer tomorrow, David Holmes, what Gordon Sondland will be asked to clarify when he comes back next week, that are going to help us to really understand as close as we can get to the story of what did President Trump focus on in his conversations with people who he had assigned to this parallel Ukraine duty.
Well, he's already characterized it as a perfect phone call, and it's extraordinary that this that the GOP is trying to sort of give a slant of this as the president being concerned about corruption in Ukraine, when I don't know that the president has gone after corruption anywhere else at this point. Also at the hearing yesterday, career State Department official George Kent alleged that Rudy Giuliani, President Trump's personal attorney, sought to manipulate U.S. policy on Ukraine and oust former Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch. Let's hear.
Over the course of 2018 and 2019, I became increasingly aware of an effort by Rudy Giuliani and others, including his associates Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman, to run a campaign to smear Ambassador Yovanovitch and other officials at the U.S. Embassy in Kyiv. During the late spring and summer of 2019, I became alarmed as those efforts bore fruit. They led to the ouster of Ambassador Yovanovitch and hampered U.S. efforts to establish rapport with the new Zelensky administration in Ukraine.
Margaret Tolliver, I want to go to Scott Anderson on this, but first let me go to you. What kind of an effect do we have going with respect to Rudy Giuliani's name continuing to come up over and over again?
Yeah, and so far the Democrats have sort of made the calculation that it would be more disruptive than useful to try to bring him in to testify. But we do know, and it is not a dispute, we know that the president created a parallel channel for Ukraine discussions that involved Rudy Giuliani, Gordon Sondland, who was the EU ambassador. It's not normally, Ukraine is not normally a part of the EU ambassador's portfolio, but he was moved over in this case, and Kurt Volker to kind of work on this inquiry parallel to a normal like Foreign Service, State Department, Career Service discussion. So we'll hear more about this, of course, when former Ambassador Yovanovitch comes to testify tomorrow. But this is, you know, this is absolutely one of the central questions. At the same time, you have some Republicans saying, well, Rudy Giuliani might have gotten out ahead of his skis, but this is an impeachment inquiry about Rudy Giuliani. Again, we're seeing kind of the testing of these two arguments. Number one, Giuliani didn't do anything wrong. Number two, if he did, it was him. It wasn't the president.
Margaret Tolliver, again, is politics and White House editor for Axios. And Margaret, appreciate your being with us this morning. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And let me go back to you on this, Scott Anderson. Scott Anderson, again, is fellow in governance studies at Brookings and senior fellow in the National Security Law Program at Columbia Law School, also senior editor and counsel for Lawfare. Is there anything that broaches, the illegal in the setting up of a back channel, which is essentially what presumably Rudy Giuliani did in the State Department, pretty much turn the other way on? Testimony seems to reveal, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the real focus that I think Kent focused on in his testimony is the damage that was being done, not necessarily the existence of the channel. Now, the existence of the channel could be its own issue. Congress has laid out in statute the expectation that all U.S. government activities in a foreign country, except for certain activities related to the military and a couple of other exceptions, none of which apply here, is supposed to be under the supervision of the ambassador or the chief of mission there. That's an establishment that's been in law, or requirement that's been along, excuse me, for several decades and really is the foundational assumption of how you structure embassies overseas. That still applies here. That's actually part of the reason they appear to have brought Bill Taylor in when they did in a couple of these conversations, to keep that sort of official channel in the loop to some extent, as Bill Taylor describes it. But the channel was problematic not just because it existed, but really because of the objectives it's advancing. And that's what Kent attacked pretty in a pretty straightforward and bold fashion, frankly, for a career official in a lot of ways, where he said, this is was wrong. I think these officials, these individuals who appeared to be personally compromised in certain cases, were actually advancing a separate set of personal interests that have nothing to do with U.S. national interests. And that's really what it gets down to with Giuliani. Again, the question you have to ask then is, well, what's the link between Giuliani and the president? But remember, Giuliani himself has come out publicly and said, everything I did in Ukraine, I did for the benefit of my client, the president. So the connection is there. Giuliani's already made it publicly. I don't know if you need him to testify on that specific point.
Well, there's also the possibility that Bolton may testify. It depends, I guess, on what Cooperman succeeds or fails in terms of explain what's going on here. We've got an appeal in the works, don't we?
Yes, exactly. And that relates back to that question of executive privilege I talked about earlier. What Bolton and Cooperman are kind of going to a court asking for a resolution of is, well, to what extent can Congress compel us to testify, given that we were both executive branch employees, not only executive branch, but in the executive office of the president, directly advising the president, kind of in that closer sphere of officials and issues that is closer to the core interest that executive privilege is supposed to protect. And they want the court to rule on the matter before they step in, essentially saying, this is absolutely legally what we are obligated to do by virtue of having been subpoenaed by the Congress. And it's, again, a little bit of a gray area there. For agency officials, meaning career officials who primarily have testified so far, or former officials, you know, they have gotten guidance from their agency saying at this point, we're not going to stop you if you're subpoenaed. That's what we've seen State Department and Defense Department cooperation say. We're not going to stop you from testifying. We're not sure if we can, or at least we're not going to try. The White House has gone further and has said, we don't want you doing this. And that's what Bolton and Cooperman are hoping to get clarity on, is whether the White House actually has that power.
Well, again, we're talking about the public impeachment hearing with Scott Anderson, fellow in governance studies at Brookings and senior editor and counsel for Lawfare. And we do want to welcome you aboard here. If you would care to give us a call and join the conversation, or if you have questions or comments, you can be part of the program. And our toll-free number is available right now. It's 866-733-6786. That number again for your involvement in the program and your calls is 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions to forum@kqed.org. And as we come up on the break here, Scott, a question from Paul who says, I'm wondering when the Democrats are going to demand the release of the full transcript of the perfect phone call, since a summary edited by the accused can hardly be considered best evidence.
It's a fair question. It's been this kind of recurring theme. But personally, I'm skeptical that there is much more to the July 25th phone call than what we see in the memo that's been released, for the simple reason that we've seen Vindman and other people who were on the call more or less verify its substance. They've mentioned a few words were left out, but nothing of major, you know, conclusory evidence that has a major bearing on the narrative. So I don't expect a lot more to come out with that. I think that may be a little bit of a false lead or red herring. Instead, I would focus on what we do know that's in the memo that was released. And that itself is highly problematic for the president.
Again, join us, listeners. 866-733-6786 is the number you can be part of the program at. And when we return, we'll talk more with Scott Anderson and you. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. The public impeachment hearings were held yesterday, and the process of impeachment against President Trump began, and there was a new revelation. We're talking about that and much else that went on yesterday. There's a lot embedded in what went on yesterday. Margaret Tolliver joined us earlier. Scott Anderson is with us, and I want to welcome Jennifer Habercorn, who is a congressional reporter with the LA Times, and thank you for being with us this morning.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you again. Let me begin with something that appeared in the L.A. Times. I wanted to get your response. Maybe you saw it. Scott Jennings, your colleague, said it was a bad day for the Democrats. They aren't going to move public opinion. There was no gotcha. Wasn't the phone call with Gordon Sunderland and President Trump perhaps a gotcha? Do you agree with your colleague on that?
Well, I think that was an opinion piece. And I, you know, there was the hearing, the news that really came out of the hearing for folks who've been closely following the impeachment hearing was that there was an additional person who heard President Trump talking to Gordon Sondland, his ambassador to the EU, asking about whether Ukraine was going to conduct these investigations that he wanted into the Bidens in the 2016 election. That was a pretty significant moment because it's another link of the president to the events that Rudy Giuliani and some of his other advisors have been that Democrats have been characterizing as this quid pro quo. Overall, the hearing, you know, it was not like the flashiest hearing you've ever seen. It was two career State Department officials who are pretty serious, but they described facts that Democrats say paint this picture that may warrant impeachment of the president.
There were a lot of facts that were not facts, though, and I wanted to check this with you. Mm-hmm. For example, there was talk about how important it was to arm Ukraine. Obviously, that's central to this whole testimony that's being given in this whole impeachment trial. And the Republicans kept talking about Obama sending just blankets, and I think you have to call them out on this. Obama didn't just send blankets, and I thought, you know, that was essentially a lie that was put forward by the Republicans.
Well, that's one of Republicans' talking points here, is that the President Trump is doing a lot to help Ukraine. Of course, they're trying to send the message that there's no—
Well, forgive me. He has done more than Obama did. That's actually another fact. But when they say Obama just sent blankets, that is not a fact.
Right. And I'm just here to tell you what I saw in the hearing yesterday. And the points that Democrats are and Republicans are going to be making in this impeachment process.
And the points are moving forward in a way that one has to ask. For example, when you had Jim Jordan talk about the star witness and say it very sarcastically about Ambassador Taylor, the Democrats are doing this in a plotting and methodical way. I think it has to be noted, didn't you think?
Yeah, Democrats are putting together a plan that they could lead to an impeachment vote. I think it's likely to lead to an impeachment vote by the end of the year. And in order to do that, they're trying to build a case, right? They're trying to build a case as to why aid to Ukraine was very important and why the Ukrainian President Zelensky would have done whatever it took to get this aid that the president was allegedly dangling over their heads. And that's why they're trying to send the message that the aid was very important. Republicans are trying to bring President Obama into this to try to embarrass him or try to send the message that President Trump was doing a lot.
Well, President Trump also, let me go to you on this, if I may, Scott Anderson. I want to bring our callers in because a lot of people want to weigh in and have questions. But there was not only talk about President Trump giving more aid to Ukraine, as I alluded to earlier, but also there seemed to be a kind of reckoning with the fact that language was used. I go back to Jim Jordan that said it's perfectly clear when, from his perspective, of course, and he was arguing that it was perfectly clear, in other words, that President Zelensky was under pressure to conform to what Rudy Giuliani or President Trump wanted. But he talked about three times when President Zelensky said there was no pressure on me and I didn't feel there was any pressure. One has to ask about that in terms of the case that the Democrats are building.
Right. And look, I mean, that's a relevant data point is his response there. You know, if there were reasons to think he was free in explaining, no, at no point did any of these communications indicate to me a sense of pressure to pursue these sorts of things, that be something you could take into consideration. That said, I think there are reasons that we have to weigh that, take that with a grain of salt. One, Zelensky still has to interact with the Trump administration. The Trump administration is going to be in charge of U.S. foreign policy for at least the next, you know, year and a half, maybe longer. And so he's not going to be able to burn that relationship with who is probably one of his country's major defense supporters over this sort of assertion saying, yeah, I was bullied by that. Zelensky's been very clear. I want out of this. I don't want to get tied up into this. It doesn't help me domestically. It doesn't help me internationally. And I want out. And the easy way to do that is to say, you know, nothing seemed that weird. I'm not going to weigh in on it here. The other factor is that just because the president didn't succeed in his efforts to bring that sort of pressure doesn't necessarily mean it was appropriate or that it's not impeachable conduct. You know, the efforts and attempts to leverage U.S. national security interests in terms of gaining one's personal political interests or personal advantage is sufficient. It's the motivation. It's the actual act of undertaking it. It's not whether or not it succeeds or not. And so these arguments that, well, you know, they didn't actually withhold the assistance, they got the assistance, you know, they actually got most of what they were asking for eventually, doesn't really matter in the end if there's a compelling case made that the president did in fact try and withhold that to advance his own self-interest. And that's the case that Democrats are making.
Well, his language was, do me a favor. Let me go to our callers and let's bring in Phil first. Phil, join us. You're on the air.
Hi. So the GOP and Trump are trying to claim that that Trump's efforts with Giuliani were to pursue corruption in the Ukraine. So Trump is the head of the executive branch, which has the DOJ and the FBI. It's ridiculous that a president would be performing his own investigation. How is it that he didn't have the FBI and his own agencies look at it? And how does it seem credible that he would claim that there was any evidence when he didn't even use his own resources to pursue them?
I'll take that as an important point, and I thank you for it. Let me give me another caller on, and that's Scott. Scott, join us. Welcome.
Hello.
Hi, Scott. Go ahead.
Hi. Okay. My first-time caller, I love your program. My question is, when President Trump is impeached, which I prophesize that he will be, does he get stripped of his ability to pardon? And I'll take my answer off the air.
I'm sorry, does he get stripped of his ability to what?
To pardon people.
Ah, well, it's a broad question, but let's go to you, Scott Anderson.
Yeah, sure. You know, the impeachment process is kind of goes in two stages. First, the House has to adopt articles of impeachment, basically indicts the president, levels sort of official accusations on a simple majority vote. And that's the process we're seeing taking place now, is those sorts of debates to arrive at that House conclusion. That is then given to the Senate that then debates whether or not to convict the president of that. There are only two consequences that come from conviction. One is potentially removal from office that the president is currently holding. The second is a potential prohibition of holding future office. And you can do any – the Senate can choose to do any combination of those things. So there's no restriction specifically on his ability to exercise pardon authority, nor, frankly, does the if the House chooses to impeach, does anything happen to the president other than the House chooses to impeach. As it did with President Clinton, he'll continue to be president and have all the same authorities. If he were removed from office, then, of course, he would lose the pardon authority. But short of that happening, that – the president's likely to keep that authority.
And let me go back, if I may, to you, Jennifer Habercorn. Liv Fruman, who is essentially an operative out of Ukraine and part of the Rudy Giuliani team, if you will, is being called to testify. And is that actually fait accompli at this point? Is he going to testify? Do you know?
No, it's not. He has. He was asked to testify several weeks ago and refused. Since then, he has come resurfaced and said that he wants to testify, indicating that he has something to talk about. But so far, nothing has been scheduled. And in most of these cases, I should say in all of these cases, Democrats have chosen to depose witnesses privately before they bring them to testify publicly. So the first step in that process would be a closed-door deposition, and that has not happened.
But they do have a deposition from Ambassador Sunderland, don't they, at this point?
They do.
And he stands I mean, he changed the story once, so he's in a perilous position in terms of the possibility of perjury if he pretty much backs off from what he said in the deposition, I presume.
He does. He'll be testifying on Wednesday, and he's probably the most interesting witness who's going to appear publicly next week. One reason for that, of course, is that he changed his testimony. The second is that he's probably the official who has had the most interaction with the president, who has agreed to testify. And we're expecting a lot of questions about, you know, why did he, you know, forget things during his deposition and then suddenly remember them? And what those conversations looked like. Certainly the witness that I'm most interested in hearing from next week.
It's also curious that President Trump has said he barely knows someone who donated $1 million to his inaugural campaign and whom, at least according to a lot of testimony, he speaks to on a fairly has talked to on a fairly regular basis. But I want to bring in more callers. And Judy, let's go to you next. Judy, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Hi there. Thank you. So my question is, if President Trump were to be impeached in the House and convicted in the Senate and essentially not were not president anymore, is there anything to stop him from simply running and winning again?
Good question. Let's go to our legal expert here, Scott Anderson.
Yeah, that is up to the Senate. So that is one of the two remedies that the Senate can impose, the two kind of penalties if he is in fact convicted. He can be barred from holding office in the future, or he can be removed from office. Again, they can mix those up as they see fit. So it's a possibility. We don't know for sure if the Senate were to do that. If they were to convict, it seems extremely unlikely they would convict given the a significant number of senators that would be needed for that outcome. But it's a possibility that he could be prohibited from doing that regardless of whether they remove him from office.
Another good legal question from a listener named Henry. He says, what can we learn from Watergate or the Clinton impeachment about the legal issues of Congress requesting testimony or documents from the executive branch and the executive branch refusing to comply? Is there legal precedent on how the court might rule?
That's absolutely right. I mean, most of the legal precedent on those questions really dates back to the Watergate era. The defining case is the United States v. Nixon case, where Nixon really comes forward and makes this very broad assertion of executive privilege at that time, against the sort of investigation going into him by, the special prosecutor, not by Congress. But the court looks at it and says, well, we have to weigh executive privilege. They're saying executive privilege is what's called a qualified privilege, meaning we have to weigh it against the other interests that are in play in the scenario. And they ultimately determined that, the claims that the Nixon administration had been making, which is that this is an absolute immunity, nothing can be turned over, wasn't true. Instead, the court could look at those documents and say, well, some of these actually should be turned over. And that's the standards being applied here. The problem is that it's a fairly fact-specific holding, at least in regards to the specific outcome. So it's not determinative. But those are certainly the things the courts will be looking at as they weigh these issues and that the lawyers on all sides are looking at as they determine their legal position and how strong they are.
It is fairly safe to say, though, and I'm going to go to you on this, Jennifer, if I may, Jennifer Haberkorn, who again is congressional reporter for the LA Times, that when we go back to the Watergate hearings, Watergate impeachment, I should say, different terrain in many ways, but both presidents seeking information about adversaries and the like. And it did seem like a trial yesterday, as I said earlier to many people, shades of Peter Rodino and Henry Hyde. Just wondering what your thoughts are, though, and the notion that there's a foregone conclusion that the Senate would not, under any circumstances, convict. I'm looking at a tweet from a listener named Wallace here. Minor leader Kevin McCarthy basically said that there is nothing the Democrats can do to make the Republicans vote for impeachment.
That's certainly the atmosphere right now. I mean, there's very little reason to think that the Senate would get 67 votes for removal from office. As Scott mentioned, that would be the next step in the process if the House does, in fact, impeach him. So in some ways, there is an attitude of a fait accompli. But of course, there's been several Democrats who've pointed out to me that when the Nixon proceedings started, we were kind of in the same place. There were very few Republicans who even entertained the idea of impeaching the president. And that kind of is inspiring the Democrats to continue going.
Yeah, but forgive me, Jennifer, there was a smoking gun, the tapes. I mean, that's right. The big difference, right?
And at this point in the Nixon proceedings, that had not come out yet. And so that's what's kind of driving the Democrats right now. If I had to put money on it, I would say that the president is not removed from office. But, a Senate trial is a long time away, and a lot of Republican senators are kind of keeping their powder dry. We've seen a few remarks, but a lot of them are saying that they're not really paying attention to the House proceedings until it comes over to the Senate.
And we'll bring another caller on, and that's you, Mark. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. Well, apropos of what you were just talking about in the comparisons to Watergate, I heard one of the analysts on MSNBC yesterday after the hearings say that he didn't think that the quid pro quo or even the Giuliani sideline foreign policy was compelling enough to change public opinion. But what he thought might be was to frame this in the context of Watergate, that what this is really about is Trump trying to affect his reelection, and to keep it in the context of election interference.
Well, the narrative here, and I'll go back to you on this, Jennifer, if I may, the narrative from the Republican side is, look, the Mueller investigation was a witch hunt. It was total fakery and should not have ever gone on. And this is simply an extension of that. They're trying to pretty much present the view that the Democrats are trying to make the election invalid of President Trump so that, well, I guess they can just get him out of office.
That's right. Kevin McCarthy, the Republican leader in the House, just did a press conference this morning and was trying to stress that Democrats have been trying to impeach the president from the beginning. And that kind of undermines the seriousness that Democrats have on impeachment. Of course, Democrats argue that the Ukraine events are extremely serious and that they're forward-looking. To the caller's point, they are trying to focus on the fact that the president was trying to have an impact on the future election, the 2020 election, and that they're hoping that that resonates with the public. You know, one of the factors here that both parties have to take into account is that there is a little bit of just fatigue about the president, about the impeachment inquiry, and there's just a general perception that politics is dirty and that some of this is expected. Of course, Democrats argue that these are events that, you know, are without precedent.
I think those are very salient points. And let me go back to you, Scott Anderson. I've got a comment with a question from a listener named Patty, who writes, do people actually understand how dangerous it is for our country for the president to behave in such a way as this? This opens us up to being compromised or blackmailed by any foreign government or criminal enterprise in search of money and power or geopolitical dominance. I think people need to gain a better understanding about why this behavior makes America unsafe, which is why it is disallowed. Could the guest please explain why this practice represents a clear and present danger to our national security?
I mean, honestly, I think the question asker did a reasonably good job herself. What she just said is exactly correct. I mean, when you are allowing public officials to say, I am going to use all the powers that come with my office that are the powers of the United States, the most powerful country in the world, to leverage them to advance my own personal interests, whether it's political, whether it's financial, whatever interests may have you, then you're going to see a breakdown in not only the rule of law, but the kind of institutions that have allowed us to maintain our status as a great power in the nation and to maintain our own national security. You'll have individual officials able to compromise that to pursue their own individual interests. And that is exactly what the founding fathers were worried about. That is why that they made bribery, treason, and high crimes and misdemeanors impeachable offenses so that the legislature could prevent a president from undertaking that sort of conduct. And that's the process we're seeing play out here. It's one designed specifically for the situation out of exactly those fears.
And I need to ask you, Jennifer Habercorn, about the attempt by the Republicans to focus attention, public attention, as well as political attention, obviously. The two are intertwined. On Vice President Biden's influence, perhaps, in getting his son Hunter Biden on the Burisma board, it does raise a lot of questions, and they remain in, I think, the public's mind. Why does someone with no experience who doesn't speak Ukrainian get on a board for $50,000, $60,000 a month? But they didn't seem to get much mileage or mobility out of that because, to I guess a great extent, there may not be any there other than perhaps Burisma feeling they could have had influence.
That's right. There is no evidence that Hunter Biden did anything wrong. Some Democrats have speculated publicly that it wasn't the best look for him to be on the board, but there is no evidence that anything was wrong. Republicans did ask, particularly one of the witnesses yesterday, George Kent, you know, why Hunter Biden might have been on this board, if he had any experience in Ukraine, if he moved to Ukraine. Mr. Kent did not really bite on those questions. The furthest he went was to say that Burisma, the company, did have some kind of public-private partnership with the embassy last year on a ward project, and that he stepped in and suggested that they sever that relationship because Burisma does not have a good reputation in Ukraine. And that was kind of the furthest it went yesterday.
They were also trying to make a good deal out of the whistleblower's identity not being revealed. And the fact is that there was a vote to essentially, it was essentially tabled, which means the Republican wish to go after bringing the whistleblower out of the dark, so to speak, was not agreed upon. I'm just wondering what your perspective is, Jennifer, in terms of the pushing of that the whistleblower has to be exposed by the GOP.
Yeah, Republicans really want the whistleblower to come forward because they feel like the president has a right to see his accuser. They're framing this as something that started with the whistleblower, and they've suggested that he's a Democratic operative who did this for political reasons. Adam Schiff, the Democrat who leads the House Intelligence Committee and has, in fact, become the kind of face of the impeachment process so far, initially wanted to hear from the whistleblower and then said that everything that the whistleblower said has been corroborated by other witnesses who are speaking freely with their name attached. The whistleblower has become very fraught. Adam Schiff originally said that he hadn't talked to the whistleblower, and then it turned out that his staff had, which has become a pretty partisan talking point from Republicans, suggesting that there's something improper going on here. There isn't any evidence of that except this statement from Schiff, which he said he should have been more clear about. I think the whistleblower is going to continue to be a really significant talking point from Republicans throughout this process. At this point, he or she has not been named, and there's no expectation that he or she would testify.
Well, it allowed for one of the rare moments of levity yesterday when I think it was Jim Jordan who said the person who started all this should come before this hearing. Mm-hmm. And Peter Welch, a Democrat from Vermont, said we'd be glad to have President Trump here. Let me go to more of your calls, and let's get Jennifer on next. Jennifer, you're on. Morning.
Yes. Thank you. Yes. Good morning. I was listening to yesterday's testimony and noted how Giuliani's name was brought up as the sort of coordinator of what's been termed an irregular channel. And Bolton described this irregular channel as having an objective that to him was, in his words, I think, counter to U.S. foreign policy. How legal is it for a private citizen to, communicate with a foreign power in this way that might run counter to U.S. foreign policy?
Yeah, it's a good question. We sort of broached it before, but let's flesh it out a little bit more with you, if we may, Scott Anderson.
Yeah, absolutely. There is no clear legal prohibition on the part of Rudy Giuliani just reaching out and engaging foreign officials. In fact, that's probably conduct protected by the First Amendment. There have been efforts to criminalize certain types of conduct like that in the past. There's talk of like certain older criminal statutes in play that could come into play to try and be used against people in similar roles. Similar threats made against John Kerry for engaging with the Iranians regarding JCPOA while the Trump administration was trying to dismantle it. The truth is that those things are things that Justice Department has never really used, at least on the modern era, because they're constitutionally questionable. Now, there is an issue with what Giuliani did in terms of if he's trying to secure something that will assist the Trump administration's campaign, or President Trump's campaign, I should say, in 2020. Then there are campaign contribution requirements and limitations about accepting those from foreign nationals, and that could fit under that rubric for a potential criminal violation or the legal violation. But the real, issue here is, again, this question of, well, who is he doing this on behalf of, and to what extent are those people using the powers of the state and of their official role to advance their own private interests? If President Giuliani was doing this entirely of his own volition and had never reached out to federal officials to try and leverage U.S. policies to get the Ukrainians to play along with these requests, it's not clear to me there would be anything illegal or anything impeachable about that. Again, it'd be a private citizen representing the president in his private capacity doing First Amendment protected activities, except for that campaign finance angle. That could be still problematic in that case. But otherwise, it doesn't get there. It's when you start incorporating it into the government policy, again, compromising U.S. foreign policy interests, leveraging U.S. foreign policies and taxpayer dollars to advance private interests. That's really where you thrust this into the impeachable conduct zone.
And there are still questions that hover over all of this. You wonder, in fact, how Paul Manafort fits into this whole Ukraine story, or if he does, and to what degree. And frankly, with Erdogan, who President Trump referred to as Erdogan, now visiting the White House and all, Turkey comes up into the picture, too, because you go back to Michael Flynn and his relationship with Turkey. Talk about questions. Here's a question, if I go to you on this, Jennifer. From a listener named Ryan, who says, what's the timeline of the impeachment process? Is this something that will be resolved before the 2020 election? Well, certainly the Democrats would like to see that happen, but what do we know at this point, Jennifer?
So it's a we're starting to get a little bit of shape to this. House Democrats would like to have a vote in the House before the end of the year. That's a pretty tight timeline because the House is only in session for a couple more weeks of the year. So they'd have to move pretty quickly. That means public hearings would have to wrap up. We're expecting House Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff to file a report that sends it over to a different House committee, the House Judiciary Committee. They would determine whether articles of impeachment should be brought forward, and they would write them. Then it would go to a big high-profile vote on the House floor, possibly about the third week of December, right before the holidays. If that happens, and if it's successful, as we think it would be, it would then go over to the Senate. The Senate would have to take it up pretty quickly, and a trial over there. It's a little up in the air how long a Senate trial would take. Some people say as few as 3 weeks. Others say as many as 8 weeks. I probably put it at the lower end of that that spectrum. So that would have a conclusion before the end of January. Democrats are pretty concerned about this bleeding too far into 2020 because they want their presidential candidate to be able to make his or her own pitch for presidency and not have it wrapped up in the impeachment squabble.
And here's a listener named Paul who writes, President Trump tried to commit high crimes but couldn't due to his own incompetence. There's no smoking gun. These hearings are to appease the Democratic base. Hopefully they'll be over before primary season begins. Probably doubtful. In the meantime, let me thank both of you for being with us. Jennifer Habercorn, again, is congressional reporter, LA Times. Good to have you aboard. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you, Scott Anderson. Good to have you as well. Fellow in Governance Studies at Brookings Institution and senior fellow in the National Security Law Program at Columbia University. Thanks, Scott.
Thank you for having me.
And we also thank Margaret Tolliv, who joined us as well. And we thank you, our listeners, for being with us. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. You can, indeed, I urge you to do this, continue the discussion online by simply going to kqed.org/forum. And remember that another hour of forum is coming up. And remember who's behind the scenes here, too. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Tina Larberg, Ariana Prale, and Susan Britton. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our interns are Caroline Smith and Sam Klein-Markman. Executive editor is Ethan Lindsay, and our chief content officer is Holly Krennan. Thank you for being with us this morning, and stay tuned for hearing about a guy who actually walked from San Diego to San Francisco. When we return, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.